There's an election coming up in Miami next week. Today, we hear from the second candidate in that race. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Zoraida Barrero came in a close second back in May to Eileen Higgins. The two are now in a runoff. That election is next Tuesday. Today, we hear from Barrero about why she's running for the office that's been vacated by her husband. Plus, filmmakers Billy Corbin and Alfred Spellman have opened a window to life in Miami through films like Cocaine Cowboys and ESPN's 30 for 30, The U. There's two new projects in the works, and they're both about Miami. They join us to discuss a new show and a play that's being put together. And the World Cup begins today, so who are you rooting for? Better yet, how much do South Floridians love the world's game?
I never wash my jersey while on a winning streak.
All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Miamians living in District 5, which covers downtown, parts of Brickell, Little Havana, and also parts of Miami Beach, will vote for their next commissioner on June 19th. The candidates are newcomer Eileen Higgins, who took the most votes in the May special election, and Zoraida Barrero, wife of the outgoing commissioner Bruno Barrero. We spoke with candidate Eileen Higgins last week, and now you'll hear from candidate Zoraida Barrero. This interview was recorded without editing her responses in equal length to make it fair to both candidates. I began by asking her why she wants to be District 5 commissioner.
I'm running because I have been part of this community for over 30 years, so of District 5, work-wise and personally. And I identify with a lot of the people in the community. I'm an immigrant. I'm a mother. I own my own business in the community. So both personally and professionally, I have to juggle and survive within the county. And there's a lot. I ran last year for City of Miami Commission, which was an exciting time because it exposed me to all the needs of the community. Unfortunately, that race, there were seven candidates, and I came in on third place, so obviously didn't make it. But if one thing was solidified with that race was that I wanted to get involved and be a part of the solution.
I'd imagine one of the tricks when you are running and you have a family member,
right,
spouse or family member who's already in that seat, that you then have to distinguish yourself. So I'm wondering, who is Zoraida Barrero? What are your policies? How do they differ? Or are they the same as your husband's?
Well, I'm my own person. I have to say, though, I'm very proud of my husband, and his commitment to public service has been amazing. That has, of course, had a little bit of influence on me because I've been very exposed to the community and the needs of the community. I am my own person. I am a professional. I've been part of the fabric of the community for many years. And I think, as when you run to be an elected official, you are going to be the voice of the residents of the district that you're representing. My experience through, like I said, being an immigrant, studying, paying my way through school, I mean, identify with so many people in the district that I know I'm going to be able to make decisions.
Would you say there are any policies or any things that you differ very differently from your husband that you might go a different direction?
Well, I think as a commissioner, I will look at every situation and give it my personal view and review. I'm not here to review every single thing that my husband has voted on. That's a waste of time. For me, I have, like I said, I come from a business perspective. I'm very much about being fiscally responsible. So every decision, every issue that comes up, I will, of course, review it and make my own decision on.
You finished second in the May election, just 222 votes behind Eileen Higgins.
Right.
What do you see as your greatest challenge before this June 19th election?
Well, I think the greatest challenge is, you know, getting out the vote. A lot of people don't even realize that there's a second election on June 19th. I, from day one, ran a campaign of going to the voters, knocking on doors, reaching out to the voters. Unfortunately, it was a very, very nasty campaign. And the more that it became negative, the more I worked hard to get my message across straight to the voters. Now at this point, is obviously people rejected that dirty campaign, because here I am. I'm very excited about that, and I'm just making sure that, you know, getting the support of the community.
Now, you've raised more money than Higgins, but as we've seen, money doesn't guarantee victory. But how do you leverage the support that you've gotten and those campaign funds to win over those extra voters? Again, this could be a very tight race.
Right. Well, it's just getting, it's you raise money to get your message across. So, of course, we've been advertising, we've been sending mailers, we've been, you know, every route that we can to make sure that people know that there's a race and to ask them for their vote.
Now, you talked about that Miami District 3 race, the city race last year, came in third. Joe Carollo won. But what did you learn from the experience that you're bringing now?
Well, you can't take anything. Obviously, you can't take anything for granted. My main thing during that race was the need of the community. It's amazing when you knock on somebody's door. It's not the same as, yeah, we have a problem with transportation and seeing it front and center. Oh, we have problems with housing, that going into someone's home and seeing the damage, how damaged it is, or it has termites, it has this. There's mold. Obviously, in our community, especially this district, Little Havana has a major crisis going on when it comes to affordable housing. There's a lot, a large community of seniors that are choosing either to eat or to pay their rent because they haven't been accepted into any, you know, gotten off those waiting lists that are eternal. It's shameful. It's shameful that this is happening. So we need to do better. We need to increase the number of affordable housing units that we have, not only for the seniors, but there's a lot of families that need workforce housing project and funding so that they are able to survive in our community.
You talk about transportation, big issue in Miami-Dade County. Transit and public transportation, you know, it's one of those things that's hotly debated. Mm-hmm. We heard from not too long ago the Transit Alliance. They're working on a campaign right now to try to bring more awareness to other options. That's an advocacy group trying to improve public transit. They said Miami's struggling in many factors, including reliability of services and bus routes. What are your priorities in trying to solve this problem? And we do have a smart plan, but what do we do moving forward?
Well, I think it's important. Obviously, the smart plan is very important because this is what we want, right? We want connectivity to all the corners of the county. And it will be ideal to have a train that goes everywhere. But realistically, funding is not there for all these projects. But we need to focus on the long-term fixes that will get us to where we need to be.
All right, so let's look at train. You said that realistically, mm-hmm. money's not there. So right. You're saying there's no chance for rail?
Oh, no. Of course there is. But we need to plan for it correctly. And, you know, a lot of these corridors may not need rail. So we need to study. There's the studies that are going on that are going to decide or are going to recommend what is the best use and what is the best solution for each area of town. Because remember, when we talk about public transportation, the main thing is density, right? If there's a neighborhood that doesn't have that many residents or that the zoning code only allows for a certain amount of floors per building, that neighborhood might not necessarily have the density that we need to qualify. Because remember, we're going to need federal dollars for these things. And to get money from the federal government to be able to fix and connect some of these areas.
What are you hearing from people when you go out there and talk to voters? What are their complaints?
Well, listen, obviously, traffic is horrendous, but public transportation, District 5 that has Little Havana, that has South Beach, that are very dependent on public transportation, are complaining about their buses. And the buses is the only thing we have right now. And in order to fix the bigger problems, they're making cuts and stuff with the lines that are affecting what we actually have now. The buses are not clean. They're not running correctly. The only way to incentivize people to use public transportation is to make it more attractive, to make it more efficient, more dependable. And so how are we supposed to be fixing the bigger problems where we're, you know, making...
One of the things that the Transit Alliance were saying is that you tend to see when ridership goes down, which it has been.
It has.
They tend to cut routes. They tend to cut services.
Right.
And they're saying, the Alliance is saying, no, improve them, increase them.
Of course.
So,
of course.
I mean, is it a matter of making, you know... There's already works to replace buses and rail, some of the trains, the cars. Mm-hmm. Is it about having more routes or hiring more bus drivers? I mean, what is it you would do? What do you want to see?
Well, obviously the routes need to be there. Sometimes they cut, they don't even have the line anymore on the weekends because it's not low ridership. But people need to start using them on the weekend and get off their, you know, get off their cars. So I think we need to work and see what the community really needs. The community that is dependent on public transportation needs those buses to keep going, to have more, to come more regularly. Unfortunately, some people get, you know, if there's an accident, there's, you know, people are sitting there or standing there because in a lot of the places, there's not even a bus shelter that they could sit down or wait for the bus. So we need to make things easier for the community with improving, and it could be simple fixes like, you know, more bus shelters, more coverage, the cleaner buses. I mean, that's it doesn't take any more money to actually buy new buses, but keep them clean. And things like that, that will help. Obviously, now we have the trolleys, which are being run by the cities, which are great. However, in a lot of occasions where the trolleys run, the lines are cut off, and people are being inconvenienced to walk a certain amount of blocks this way or that way to get, you know, the trolleys, which is fine maybe for you and me, but we have to keep in mind who's using the system. The elderly have a lot of difficulty actually getting to and making those 3-4 extra blocks to get to the trolley. So we need to keep all that in mind when deciding what to do, what to cut, and who it's going to affect.
We're talking with Zoraida Barrero. She's one of the two candidates in the special election District 5 that is coming up June 19th. Her opponent is Eileen Higgins. Zoraida Barrero, of course, wife of the outgoing commissioner, Bruno Barrero. Again, that election is June 19th. Let's move to another issue. Flooding. Sea level rise and flooding, and it's something that we see a lot of here, not just in Miami Beach. We're starting to see more inland flooding. Mm-hmm. We're starting to see coastal cities experiencing this up and down Florida, really, as the water tables are rising. What role does the county play? There is a resiliency officer, but what more can Miami-Dade do in preparing? And then how do you tell people, you know, we're doing to try to fix this problem?
Right. And I think education is key, obviously. I think we are aware of the problem that it's getting worse. Last year, the flooding here, even in the city of Miami, was horrible. And the residents, the voters, voted for the bond issue to help tackle it. So, I mean, I think we're heading in the right direction, but education is key. I was very encouraged to see city of Miami is creating an app. They're going through the process to create an app to keep residents, anyone who wants to sign up, notified and alerted when flooding will happen, what areas are going to happen, and diverting. These roads are going to be closed, so use the other route. And that's exciting that it's happening in soon, because I think that's going to be key. Also, the building codes. We need to work on better building codes. So going forward, you know, our homes are a little more elevated, so we don't have to go through, you know, the damage that comes when we go through the...
You know, all of this, of course, costs money. So how do we finance this flooding infrastructure? We see what Miami Beach is doing. This, of course, is, you know, part of that area is in the district. You know, are we asking voters pay more taxes because we're going to maybe have to raise roads or build a pump system, or we're going to have to do something?
Right.
Because we saw it during the hurricane last year. A lot of downtown was underwater.
Right.
So how do we pay for it?
Well, we have to be more efficient with our money. Obviously, you know, the bond issue passed. So City of Miami is working on sea level rise issues and helping. But, you know, whatever it is that we need to do, we need to focus on getting the money. A lot of times I think when it comes to the budget, we need to be more efficient to make sure the money's there.
So before even thinking of taxes, you're looking...
I think efficiency is key. I think we need to be efficient in every single step of the county.
I know it's a tough one for people to say, but taxes at some point, I mean, we need to build infrastructure. We need to replace roads. We need to do a lot of things. Is that just a bad word people don't like to say?
Well, unfortunately, there's a lot of people that are struggling. This district, the funny thing about this district, it has the richest people in Miami, and it has the poorest people in Miami. And then, of course, the middle of the road that have their homes that are struggling. So, of course, taxes are a big deal for everybody. I think people would maybe not be as hesitant to pay more taxes if they saw the results, where it was going to, that it's getting what they need done. But I think, and that their government is working as efficiently as possible to get all the needs of the community met.
Let's move to another big issue here, of course, affordable housing, because as you said, we have some of the wealthiest people here, but we have a lot of people just, you know, they're spending 40-45% of their income on housing. It's the challenge that Miami faces. We have this massive growth. According to U.S. Census Bureau data, though, Miamians spend a larger percentage of their income on housing than any other major city. What can you do to fix that?
Well, unfortunately, the prices of the properties keep coming up. I think working with the affordable which we discussed is key for some parts of the community. And, you know, and just making opportunities available for and incentivizing. You know, there's a lot of builders that are working on projects. We need to incentivize those builders to add a certain amount of units.
So how do you do that? Okay, that's also one of the arguments. But at the same time, they're looking at that and saying, well, but bottom line, the dollars.
Of course, it has to be incentivized through financially and credits. Also, you know, right now, the county itself has a lot of property. You know, some of these affordable housing units or buildings are in places that it has a lot of parking. We need to look at all those sites and see how they could be maximized and work within that, which we already own, to incentivize the builders to build more housing there.
It was 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago, Miami-Dade County created the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, and that was to help subsidize affordable housing. A decade later, there's very little money in it. It hasn't really been, nothing's really happened with it. How has this county government proved that it can or really wants to solve this problem?
Well, the problem is getting worse, obviously, and we need to move forward and we need to make sure that the funds are there. And, you know, if we need to tap into the general fund dollars to do it, I think that's definitely one of the bigger issues that we have in the county. And let's see what we can do to help.
One thing, too, this really down your alley. I mean, you run a healthcare company in Little Havana for a number of years now, focused on affordable care for seniors. As a District 5 commissioner, I mean, how do you prioritize funding? Also, the fact that we just found out that the new law in Florida says all senior homes, nursing homes must have generators that can go for so many days after a storm if power goes out. But I mean, for you, how do you prioritize funding and make sure that these centers have what's necessary to protect seniors?
Well, the thing that happened last year with the hurricane, we learned a big lesson. We're not ready. We weren't ready, and we need to get ready. We need to do whatever must be done to get ready. And generators are life-saving, so we need to, as a community, make sure that that's addressed. And, you know,
should that be up to the nursing homes, or should governments, county government, city government, the state pay for that?
Well, the ones that are privately owned, have to provide their own generators and provide for that, of course, make arrangements. Now, the thing is, remember, there's a lot of housing units, and those seniors need the generators. So the county is responsible for that. We saw it. Unfortunately, we saw it firsthand in many of the buildings that either the generators weren't working or they were working, but they were, you know, really old and the gas was affecting some of the residents. So when it comes to the seniors, we need to do everything to protect them.
Let me finish with this. What is your vision for District 5 and in Miami-Dade County as a whole for the next 5-10 years? I mean, how do you achieve that vision? What do you want?
Well, District 5 is an incredible space. It's in the heart of the city downtown. We have so many areas which are exciting, Little Havana, downtown, the beach. We need to make sure that we work to make things better. There's a lot of progress going on. A lot of people are staying behind. We need to take into consideration all the different groups, all the different needs of the community, and whatever decision as a commissioner, make sure that they're all these needs are taken into account moving forward. I obviously, we need to fix the traffic problems that we're having. Obviously, with public transportation, we need to improve the housing crisis that we're having. We need to have more units. Even within our district, even the beaches. So the beaches are one of our most important, the biggest park that we have. One of the most important things that we have in our city that attracts the tourists, that brings economic growth and tourist dollars in. We need to have a healthy beach.
It's a very diverse district, as you said. I mean, you have parts mm-hmm. of Brickell, the beach, Little Havana.
Right.
So, I mean, and downtown. It's a very diverse, different goals for different people.
Right, right. And I think, like I said, we need to, every decision that is made, we need to have everyone educated on it, everybody on board, even with feedback. Sometimes people are upset because they weren't accounted with, or the decisions are made that, hey, what about me? Like when the route is cut, hey, what about me? I'm a senior. Now I have to walk 3-4 blocks. So we need to take all this into account moving forward, any decision that is made, so that the district thrives. Because obviously we're one district within the county, but this particular district is very diverse, very needy, very exciting at the same time.
And again, that was Zoraida Barrera running for Miami-Dade County District 5. Both, we're going to have the interviews with Mrs. Barrera and her challenger, Eileen Higgins, on our website, WLRN.org, today. Coming up, they're behind the famous documentary series Cocaine Cowboys, and now they're turning it into a play. Miami filmmakers Billy Corbin and Alfred Spellman join us next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, for those of us who have spent most of our lives in South Florida, we know this place is filled with fascinating characters with even more fascinating stories. Filmmakers Billy Corbin and Alfred Spellman have dedicated their livelihoods bringing those stories to the screen. They head up the documentary production company Raconteur, and it means one who tells stories with skill. They're well known for the Cocaine Cowboys documentary series, exploring Miami's complicated relationship with the cocaine trade back in the 1980s. And there was the ESPN 30 for 30 films, The U, and there was a second one, all about the University of Miami's football program. The U, the first one, that was about the 80s program. Raconteur is back with a slate of exciting new projects. They're producing a television series. They're working on a television series titled A Sunny Place for Shady People, which explores some of South Florida's most dynamic crime stories, and there are plenty. And they're developing a stage play of Cocaine Cowboys, which is set for April of next year. I'm pleased to have in studio with me Billy Corbin and Alfred Spellman. Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having us.
Vote for Eileen Higgins.
All right. I knew you were going to do that. That's all right. He was listening to the interview.
Let's be real about this. Zoraida Barrera's sole qualification is that she is the spouse of a corrupt commissioner responsible for the Marlins Park boondoggle. Vote for Eileen Higgins.
Does it sound like you're going to be doing a film about this?
I'm getting equal time right now.
There you go. All right. You know what? Let's talk about, you've got a couple things in the works. I know there's something you can't tell us about, but you are working on.
There's like two things we can't tell you about.
There are plenty of things. You guys are pretty busy. But I want to ask you about this. The new series, TV series you're working on, A Sunny Place for Shady People. And this is about some of the stories, that exemplify South Florida politics and
all about Bruno Barrera
and crime. Why do you guys want to tell this? What was the impetus behind this one?
So we've been looking for years for a vehicle to tell shorter form stories that don't need kind of a feature documentary treatment. And Billy and I have always said we'd love to have kind of our own version of 60 Minutes or Dateline, where we could explore stories in a more short form fashion, because South Florida is a sunny place for shady people, and you end up with these great, fascinating stories, but that don't. Need an hour and a half to tell. So
it's funny. You say you only have 20 minutes, to do a segment. We have 2 hours, and it's sort of, I guess the grass is always greener on the other side of the street. We look at it as like we have this database being lifelong Floridians and native Floridians, I should say, and lifelong Miamians of great stories we would love to tell and have been looking for a vehicle to do so.
Was there one or two in particular? Because I mean, looking at some of the ones that you guys are working on, a story about Bal Harbour Police and so forth. But was there any one that really launched this? Like, oh, we've got to tell this story now.
Honestly, Marlins Park was certainly up there. The Marlins Park boondoggle, I think, is one of the greatest robberies in the history of, it's like an Ocean's 11, a type of movie, and right in broad daylight in front of our very eyes by our own county and city governments. But really, the Bal Harbour, when you consider that there was some of the biggest drug and possibly terror money launderers working at that time. I'm talking about over $85 million in illicit funds laundered by this criminal organization, and it was the Bal Harbour Police Department. I mean, a neighborhood that is like a mile long.
And Billy, remind them too, in case that for those who just moved here recently, what that story was about, what happened there.
Sure, it was this. I mean, you had this tiny village, this tiny police department in a neighborhood known for really its luxurious shopping mall, and it's literally a mile long. Most of the police activity involves speed traps, you know, along Collins A1A there, and of course shoplifting type of crimes at the Bal Harbour shops. And then you had this Thomas Hunker, this Chief Hunker from Miami Beach, who was very well known locally in money laundering circles about doing undercover sting operations, seizing money, and getting to keep a lot of it, creating a windfall for the departments that he was working for. So he comes into Bal Harbour, and this is not an area with any sort of drug activity or money laundering activity, and he brought drug activity and money laundering activity to the community so he could basically make money that is totally unaccounted for and spend it on himself.
Is there the method of which you guys are approaching this? Is it anything like your past work? Or are you guys trying a whole new setup?
I think it's a little bit more tongue-in-cheek than we've done in the past. There's so much of the corruption here in South Florida is so specific. It has a particular flavor to it. The type of graft that you see here is just so brazen that it demands kind of a more comedic take on it, which is, I think, our approach.
So you guys had a pilot recently,
yes,
right? And so, I mean, where are you now in this project, and when could we expect it?
So we're wrapping up the pilot now. We're developing another 9 episodes of it, so we'll have a 10-episode series, and hopefully we'll have that ready for 2019.
And it's kind of done in the style of a classic, almost tourist film, you know, with a bouncy soundtrack, a very sort of like Wish You Were Here, colorful fonts, and Manolo himself from Scarface we have Stephen Bauer doing the narration on it.
And what platform is it going to be on? How will we watch it? Or are you guys still working on that?
We're still working out those details right now.
All right. I wanted to go back to something, by the way, because, you know, for people who don't know, I mean, going back to the very beginning for you guys, you guys produced this lesser known documentary back in 2001 called A Raw Deal, Question of Consent. This is a film that followed the rape of a stripper at the University of Florida at a frat party. You know, I wanted to know from you guys, I mean, that was, you're talking, you know, almost 20 years back, that this is an issue that is still being discussed. It's still happening. Does that surprise you?
It's one of those cases. When we stumbled across this case, Billy and I were both in college at the time, and we had friends who were at the University of Florida who were telling us about it. And we decided to take a leave of absence from the University of Miami and go make a documentary, and that really launched our careers. And since then, you're right. I mean, the best example, people talk about the Duke lacrosse case from back in the mid-zeros. But you see this crop up time and time again, year after year. This is kind of a perennial issue that still afflicts college campuses.
And what was so unique about that case, of course, is that there was videotape evidence that was that wound up as a result of our public record laws, the Sunshine Laws here in the state of Florida, as a matter of public record. And we incorporated that video into this he said, she said, with the fraternity men, and then the alleged victim, the exotic dancer. And what was compelling about it is that objective, educated, reasonable people watch the videotape footage and disagree about whether or not they're witnessing a consensual sex act or a sexual assault, which is what was so compelling and controversial about the case. And I think that it's incredibly educational. In fact, the grandmother of the alleged victim said that she believed that, and she was a house mother actually at the time at a fraternity house in Gainesville, the University of Florida. She said that every incoming freshman class at every university in the country should have to watch this documentary to just understand the nuances of these types of cases.
Have you ever thought of going back to that topic?
Certainly, especially because, I mean, you politely refer to it as a lesser-known documentary. It is our least-known documentary in our first work, and to Alfred's point, it was the one we went to the Sundance Film Festival with and really helped to launch our careers. And in a way, it's almost unfortunate that it hasn't been more high-profile. So, and because it's such an important and serious issue that's worthy of that kind of open conversation. And yeah, I would like to someday.
What was the response like? And what was it like for you at Sundance? I mean, you're two young guys out there, and this is your first, you know, I guess your introduction to the biz, but
it was freezing cold is what it was.
Oh, okay.
I water ski. I don't snow ski. Who the hell wants to go out to Park City, Utah in January? When we got off the plane, we left Miami. We got off the plane and I looked at Alfred and our other producing partner, David Sipkin. I said, the hell are we doing here? This is crazy. Let's go back to Miami. It's freezing, guys.
What was the response like? What did you, I mean, you know, what did people say to you? And I mean, what did you think?
It was tremendously controversial. The film was on the cover of the New York Post out of Sundance, and because we had incorporated portions of the videotape in the documentary, and it created a firestorm of controversy. And at the time, we were the only filmmakers from South Florida having been invited to Sundance. Then we were the youngest filmmakers at that point as well. I think we were 22 at the time. And everybody said, are you guys going to New York or LA? And you know, the agents were calling, the managers were calling. What's the next step? And we said, we want to go back to Miami and tell stories from our hometown the same way that Woody Allen or Spike Lee tell stories in New York.
Did anybody try to talk you out of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A lot of people told us, well, you can't. I mean, how could you stay in Miami? What type of thing is that to do? Like, you have this huge hit film out of Sundance. Of course you're going to go to New York or LA. And Billy and I said, no, we want to come back here and tell stories from our hometown and build a company and build a brand out of Miami.
And so now we come to Cocaine Cowboys.
We needed a calling card film, and that was it.
You know what? Going back to that film, I think what I think is the most fascinating is the people you talk to. You know, some of these former hitmen and pilots and just all level of drug dealers and folks. And I'm wondering, like, you know, one, how you found them. Two, how did you get them to open up and talk about this? Or did they want to?
Well, we joke now that when you're released from prison, your first call is to your mother and your second call is to Raconteur to tell your story.
It has the added benefit of being true.
It does. But at that time, it was difficult. We had one documentary under our belts. We had a nice little press kit out of it. So that helped convincing people that we were legit and we wanted to tell the story. And, you know, we had made a decision early on. Stylistically, our documentaries, we don't use a narrator. We don't put our thumb on the scale. It's a very journalistic type of storytelling that we try to do. And so giving people who had made mistakes in their lives or in the case of people who are still in prison that we interviewed, an opportunity to tell their story somewhat without judgment, I think, is probably a unique thing. You know, and that was kind of the stylistic choice that we made with Cocaine Cowboys.
You know, this week we had Dick Gregory, the former U.S. attorney.
Sure. Yes.
And it was so much fun listening to this guy's stories. And it was interesting because we were talking about, for example, like he was talking about the lack of sophistication for some of these drug groups. I mean, they just like bring big, massive suitcases of money and they're spilling it everywhere. And, you know, they would just have piles of it in an apartment. And I wondered, like, when you were talking with some of these guys for your documentary, you know, did you hear these kind of stories? Did anything surprise you about what was going on in Miami at the time?
Well, I think that what you ended up finding out was it became such a gold rush in Miami at the time that you have, you know, there's the old phrase, you know, first come the innovators, then come the imitators, then come the idiots. And that's really what happened is that you had people who were very innovative in terms of drug smuggling methods being copied by people who were weekend warriors who thought that they had a speedboat in the backyard that they could just head out to Bimini and pick up a load of 100 kilos and come back on in.
And the government was still playing catch up. You didn't have to be that sophisticated to get away with it. And with the quantities of drugs being smuggled in and the quantities of money being generated, you could afford to lose a few loads here and there of cash or drugs.
And he said now it's so sophisticated and the government still can't keep up with them.
Well, we get asked about this all the time. And I say the best barometer of this is simple supply and demand, right? So if a kilo of cocaine in 1978-79 was $50,000 on the street, and now in Miami, you could probably buy a kilo of cocaine for somewhere between 25 and 30 grand. That tells you all you need to know about supply and demand and how effective we've been at interdiction.
We're talking with filmmakers Billy Corbin and Alfred Spellman, talking about some of the projects they've worked on, like Cocaine Cowboys, The U. There were two of those. They've got new projects in the works, as we've been discussing, and I want to ask you about that. You're coming back to the Cocaine Cowboys, but now it's a stage performance. And by the way, we were joking about this earlier because I asked you, is it a musical? You said no, but you're calling it a musical. All right, so what is this, Billy?
In-house, you have to refer to it as something, so we call it Cocaine Cowboys the Musical. It is not, in fact, a musical. But when we were first researching Cocaine Cowboys, went through a lot of trouble to obtain the deposition of Jorge Rivi Ayala, who was the hitman that we ultimately interviewed in the movie as research in the project. And I attended New World School of the Arts for high school. Went to theater class there, and when I was reading the deposition, I was really struck by what a fascinating monologue it was. It was really the prosecution's effort to get Rivi to open up about all these murders that he had either committed firsthand or was aware of chapter and verse in Miami-Dade at the time.
And he had over 1,300 pages of deposition, right?
On and on and on. And I mean, there were dozens of murders that he was talking about and discussing in vivid and gory and disturbing detail. And I said, my God, this reads like a monologue. It reads like a stage play, like a one-man show. And that was sort of a stupid idea that we all filed away in the back of our minds. And then years later, returned to that concept and met Michelle Hausman, the artistic director at Miami New Drama, at the Colony Theater in Miami Beach, who was doing, I think, some of the best dramatic theater work around. Queen of Basel was brilliant. He did this season. Last season, he did Our Town in three languages, in English, Spanish, and Creole. It was just incredible. And he's doing amazing work. And he said, you guys want to get in? I'm like, into the theater business. And I said to Alfred, I'm like, the documentary thing is documentary business is all right, but if you want to make real money, you go into the theater business. That's really what you do. And so we decided that we started this collaboration with Miami New Drama, and the first project of hopefully many to come is this Confessions of a Cocaine Cowboy concept.
So this is set to come out next year, in 2019.
I think April, Alfred, when is it?
Yeah, April 2019.
Yeah, they just announced, Miami New Drama just announced their new season.
So how much of did you pull from that deposition? How much of when you're writing this script? I mean, because, it gets juicy.
Well, most of the source material is actually from our interviews that we had conducted with Rivi in prison in Florida back in 2005.
2004, 2005.
Yeah. So that's mostly where the material derives from. But, in addition to sort of being this recreation of the Cocaine Cowboys era, it really talks a lot about the state of Miami in the 90s, which is when the prosecution of Griselda Blanco, La Madrina, the godmother, who was the boss of Jorge Rivi Ayala, he was her enforcer, her lead hitman. But it also speaks to where the world is today. I mean, ultimately, this is a lot about, it's an immigration story. It's a Miami story and our different immigrant communities and indigenous communities, for that matter. I mean, I think it's the only city in America where we refer to white people as the Anglo community in America. So it's a lot about that, that element of Miami, that, that Game of Thrones and paradise that we kind of have, this tribal element to the community. But also violence, this explosion of automatic gunfire on the streets of shopping malls and on highways. And I mean, the Mac 11, for crying out loud, was known as the Miami Chopper. That was its nickname. And I think that has a lot of parallels to contemporary violence and mass shootings that we're seeing today. So I think it's going to be a little bit more thoughtful and profound than anybody might imagine from a Cocaine Cowboys theatrical experience.
And so, again, coming out next year, what can you tell us about what we're going to see on the stage and how it's going to play out? Because this is new territory for you, right? We're not seeing the stories come out, with interviews. This is a stage live performance.
It's a very different art form, of course, and you don't want to use too much video or screens. You don't want people to come out. It's a lot of trouble for people to come out and pay and go to a live event. You want them to experience something that they can only experience as a live event, and not go, well, I could have just stayed home and watched the documentary in my underwear on Hulu or Netflix or whatever, So yeah, there's very much an effort on the part of the creative team to create an experience that is unique and essential to the live environment that we're going to be performing in.
What's that like for you guys? I mean, going from film, because I think I'd read somewhere too, you had considered, I think with your other project, doing a podcast, but trying to enter all these other realms of storytelling, these other mediums. But I mean, is that just the ultimate goal? Like, let's find as many different ways in telling stories, or is stage just the next thing?
That's the name of the company,
When we named the company, we specifically did not call ourselves Raconteur Films or Raconteur Productions. We were looking for a cool name for our company. And when we were in high school, Billy and I had the law firm sounding Spellman Corbin Productions label. And we said, okay, we got to
injured at work. Yeah, right. Car accident, call Spellman Corbin Productions.
So we needed to find a name. And so we liked Raconteur, and we said, well, we saw storytelling kind of evolving, and it wasn't necessarily just going to be something we were going to tell in film or television per se. And so stage, publishing, and podcasts are definitely, all three are on the plate.
Miami has changed so much. I love this story. So I grew up in South Florida, as I mentioned before, to the listeners. But I grew up, a lot of my time was up in West Palm Beach. But that I remember watching Miami evolve. I remember, you know, and of course, it's so much of it was what you saw on TV. And I'll even be the first to say, is like, I loved Miami Vice, and but I loved all these stories. For you guys, what have you seen in the changes in Miami? How do you describe it to people? Because you're looking for these stories, and there's still plenty of them to tell.
It's funny. We were in the midst of the Great Recession. We were working on a documentary called The Ponzi State, which was going to look at Florida as a case study in the Great Recession. And remember at the time, 2008, 2009, 2010, word was, you talk to practically anybody, they said, well, it's going to take at least 10 years for this real estate to market in South Florida to rebound. We have all this inventory. It's nobody's living in these condos in downtown. What a disaster this is. Everybody's underwater on their mortgages. And we started work on this documentary, and we were about 6, 7, 8 months into it, and all of a sudden things started to come back. And all of a sudden you had a huge surge of tourism in the summer, which we hadn't seen before, around 2011, 2012. And then all of a sudden the real estate market came back.
Russian investment. Look at all that.
Yeah. And you had this incredible turnaround, which nobody at the time would have predicted. And all of a sudden we're standing there with this document, this project, and we're saying, well, wait a second, you know, things are moving too quickly for us to be able to put this together and be able to tell. A year from now, it's going to be a totally different story. So you have to stay agile here. You have to keep your eyes open and move quickly because things change on a dime.
And I think we could have very easily gotten stuck into this perception that we were sort of local filmmakers or provincial projects that we were doing, but they really do. Miami is known the world over, you know, and more importantly, I think the Florida of today is the America of tomorrow, particularly South Florida and Miami. If you want to know what challenges we'll face or calamities will befall us as a nation in the years to come, you need only look to see the trends in politics, crime, fraud, corruption. We really, start those trends, we master them and export them. You're seeing happening in Miami, the third world economy that we have created here. The distance between the gulf between the haves and the have-nots, the overtly corrupt government, the fact that Florida, you know, one of our top industries is Medicare fraud, and we hired and rehired and reelected one of the biggest Medicare fraudsters in the history of America, governor. He was really, Rick Scott was really Trump before Trump. The idea that we would take this overt lying fraudster who was going to buy his way into the executive, the highest executive office in the state of Florida, we really start these kinds of trends, you know.
What you're talking about is the fact that his company many years back was fined by the federal government.
Yes, Rick Scott was CEO of the HCA Columbia Hospital chain while it was committing the largest Medicare fraud in the history of the United States.
Before I finish up, because I'm short on time here, so I wanted to ask you got a project you're working on you can't talk about, but I wanted to tease that out. But there's something else you were telling me that can you mention that you want to do? Something about another culture here in South Florida that's unique.
Oh, sure. Well, we did a documentary called Dogfight, D-A-W-G. People thought it was a 30 for 30 about Michael Vick. It was about illegal, unsanctioned backyard brawls in Southwest Miami-Dade in the West Perrine area. It was the subculture that Kimbo Slice really invented, and then a new generation of fighters tried to really, was inspired by that business model to literally try to fight their way out of those neighborhoods to a better life for themselves and their families. And it premiered on Netflix in 2015. We're working on a sequel now called Dogfight Round 2. And our next theatrical venture after the Cocaine Cowboys production with Miami New Drama will be a musical about Dogfight, working with the local group Mayday, who are this brilliant collective of musicians and hip hop artists, I think it's one of those ideas I call Hamilton crazy, because it's like, you know, there's good ideas, there's bad ideas, there's crazy ideas, and then there's Hamilton crazy ideas, an idea so crazy that it might just work.
It's a real musical.
It is a legit hip hop musical about bare knuckle backyard brawls in Southwest Miami Dade.
So that's another project that they're putting together. But of course, you know, as we mentioned, they're working on a TV series, A Sunny Place for Shady People. They're also bringing a Cocaine Cowboys to the stage. That's coming in April of 2019. Again, talking to Billy Corbin and Alfred Spellman, talking about the project that they're working on from Raconteur, their company, their production company. Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure. I really appreciate it. Looking forward to the new projects, man.
Thanks. Vote for Eileen Higgins.
All right, still to come. World Cup has started today. How are you going to be watching and celebrating? That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the 2018 World Cup in Russia kicked off today. Russia, the host country, defeated Saudi Arabia just about an hour ago in the tournament's first match. 5-0 was the score. The U.S., of course, didn't make the cut. But for so many fans in South Florida, it doesn't matter because this is a melting pot, you know, and we have fans from all of the countries represented in this year's tournament. I spoke with the Miami Herald's Michelle Coffin about this year's event and what we can expect. And I started by asking, compared to New York, L.A., Seattle, or Portland, where does Miami and South Florida rank when it comes to soccer passion?
Well, it's actually bigger in Miami than any of those cities you name it. Miami, every year for the past several World Cups and Champions League and European Champions tournaments, Miami has the highest TV ratings of any of the markets in the United States. It's always either number one, if worse, number two or three, but it's almost always the highest rated market for television for international soccer, not just World Cup, but also Champions League, Copa America, any Champions League, European Championships, any kind of international soccer. Miami is watching and paying attention because we are such a melting pot of the world. And the fact that the U.S. is not in this World Cup will not in any way, shape, or form affect the attention that people down here are giving it, which it will in other parts of the country. I'm guessing that some of the numbers may be a little bit down because the United States isn't in it. But here in Miami, there are people who are as much, if not more, interested in the teams from Argentina, from Brazil, from Peru in the World Cup for the first time in 36 years, Costa Rica, not to mention France and Germany and England and Colombia. So there's so much interest in South Florida, much more than any other place in the United States.
And you talk about that diverse mix of Latin Americans, Europeans. Who really has the largest, the most vocal fan base in South Florida?
It depends who's playing on what day. I mean, right now, the Peruvian fans are very, very excited. They just had a friendly here in March. It was Peru against Croatia. And there were 47,000 people at Hard Rock Stadium for a friendly between Peru and Croatia. And, you know, I would say 46,000 of them were Peruvians. And I personally know a lot of Peruvians that are going to Russia for the World Cup. This is a huge deal for them to make the World Cup for the first time in almost four decades. So right now, the Peruvian fan base is huge. Colombia has a humongous fan base in Miami, in South Florida, Brazil, of course, Argentina, of course. So it's even more exciting for people down here.
Yeah, the Miami Herald had this great piece recently. You highlighted a fan from every country represented in the World Cup. What did that teach you about the kinds of fans in South Florida that you didn't already know?
Right. Well, a friend of mine came up with an idea, said, wouldn't it be cool if you could find 32 fans, one from each country in Miami? It's such a diverse market. I bet you could find that many, you know, fans. And it sounded like a very cool idea. His name's Walter Villa. He's a former editor at the Herald. And I said, Walter, that sounds like a great idea. And I started looking. Of course, it was very easy to find a fan from Brazil, a fan from Argentina, a fan from Colombia, England, Germany. It was not so easy to find somebody from Iceland, from Senegal. Senegal was actually one of my hardest ones to find. Even Denmark was not super easy to find, Saudi Arabia, Egypt. So it took me quite a while to find one from each, but I did. I was able to find at least one fan from all 32 countries, and I did a little profile on all 32 fans and also asked them in passing what is the best place in South Florida to get food, native food from their country. So in addition to getting their World Cup thoughts and some of their memories and their favorite players, I also got a great list of 32 fabulous ethnic restaurants that I am now going to have to go sample. All 32.
Real quick, tell me, who do you think is going to win? Who do you want to see win?
It's really hard. I mean, I would say my brain is telling me that Germany could probably win again, but history shows that it's very, very difficult to repeat. I think Brazil has so much to play for this time because they want to make up for that debacle of 4 years ago. They really want to redeem themselves. They have a fabulous team that I think has an excellent chance. France is another team that is loaded with talent, and I think they could definitely be there at the end. Argentina, I know I'm naming too many teams, but you have Messi trying to win the one trophy that he's never won in his life. I would say those are the main favorites. Spain, of course, is an aging team, and this last group wants to go out with a bang. So I think, you know, on paper, the favorites would be Germany, Spain, Argentina, maybe France. One team I would say to look out for is Belgium. Belgium has a lot of players who play in the English Premier League. They are loaded with talent, and a lot of is expected this time of the Belgian team.
Michelle Kaufman of the Miami Herald. Michelle, enjoy watching the games.
Thank you. You too.
All right. And by the way, Michelle's covered a lot of World Cup events. And, you know, we talked to her before today. This is pre-recorded. And it was, of course, before FIFA chose the North American group of U.S., Canada, and Mexico to host the 2026 World Cup. And since that, she has said,
I can almost guarantee you that Miami will be one of the host cities.
All right. Well, I'm going to hold it to her. We'll see. All right. So over the past week, we've been asking you what teams are you cheering for and what are some of the World Cup rituals. We heard from many of you. Matteo Togni from Pompano Beach, Florida, is going for Switzerland in this World Cup. And he shared with us what he does for good luck.
I love this classic event. It brings a lot of people together. As far as rituals are concerned, well, I'm not sure I should mention this since you probably will be playing this on the radio, but I never wash my jersey while on a winning streak. So just wash my jersey after a loss because you have to get rid of the negative mojo that comes with a loss to start fresh and go for a win the next time. Let's just hope that in the next month, I won't be doing too much jersey washing.
Well, honestly, Matteo, let's just hope that if in case you're not, that you're not offensive to all the people around you because you're not going to be smelling too good. But thank you for sharing that story with us. So, again, we're going to be hearing from a lot of you over the next month. Again, let us know who you're rooting for and how you're celebrating the World Cup. Just text the word sundial to 63735. Well, that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Friday, a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you next week.